From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in warming Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make nice games. This week, we're back to the drawing board for another Nice Thinking, where one of your nice hosts or a nice guest brings an idea to the clubhouse to workshop on air. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Okay, important format update, people.
Yes.
We've done a couple of these Nice Thinkings.
Right, in fact.
Yeah.
I've done one or two.
Yeah.
Steven.
One or two.
Ellen.
I don't remember.
At least two. At least.
Probably.
But we have our first Nice Thinking guest. So let's welcome him. Adam, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. How are we doing? It is warm over here in the UK today. I think we just established it's about 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 36 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, it's too 97. Warm. Yep.
So you're getting right into it, but I do have to make sure that we get your full name on air. And here's the thing. I don't know how to pronounce your last name. And I didn't ask you ahead of time. I just looked at it like, right. That looks pretty British.
So hello, everyone. My name is Adam Clues-Boyne. I am the co-founder of indie studio Beta Jester here in the UK. I'm also the co-founder and one of the podcast hosts on Game Dev London that you may have heard on mentioned on a previous episode.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll get to that at some point as well.
You contacted us out of the blue a while ago and said, hey, we like your Nice Games Jam format. Can we steal it? And I think immediately we were like, yes, please.
Uh-huh.
And you had a pair of really great episodes that we incorporated back into the show because we played the games you made. And man, I'd say like, thank you for like taking our concept and like doing more with it. I think that was really, we really found a lot of satisfaction in seeing that and seeing it sort of travel out of the clubhouse and be successful elsewhere. But also the two games you guys made were really, it was really fun.
Right? It was really fun.
Yeah, they were good.
Yeah. I'll have to admit, and I'll have to add this to the meta as well, is that co-founder, and also listener to all of Nice Games Club's episodes over the last sort of 2-3 years. I started from the beginning and then went all the way through and just about caught up when I got to my episode, which I was like, yes, good time. because of that, which has been, it's been a fantastic journey. Obviously, I saw the Nice Games Jam evolve from, you know, the early ones and just how it changed and stuff. And going into Global Game Jam, I was like, I mean, this is just such a good format. Like, what happens if we bring it over our side and try it ourselves? Can we make a game in an hour? And then we made two. We had two different teams. Honestly, one of the most fascinating things was listening to you three try and play it and get a number of the rules wrong. And I have never realized the detail I need to put into writing rules down. And
yeah,
I heard people, and I'm just sitting, I was there going, no, that's not what it's for. Don't do that.
In fairness, we did have to convert back to Fahrenheit when we read the rules.
Right, yeah.
So, that's fair. Yeah. Completely changes everything.
I think even as we were playing, we were like, are we getting this right? And we're like, oh, if we're not, then it's a lesson to the developer.
Oh, it was a lesson learned. It was a lesson absolutely learned.
Yeah.
But again, it was fascinating. It was fascinating to see that kind of angle because it's a really good lesson on user experience. And it's about how you know, even in that really short form, you would think you wouldn't have to deal with that. But actually, you very much have to talk about how it's not built into the game, then you have to explain it very clearly. And if you don't, people will get the wrong idea. And it's as much a lesson there as it is anywhere else.
And it's really difficult because you're whipping up this game together in an hour and you're not taking great notes. And yes, you can go back and listen to the recording, but sometimes you go back and you're like, wait, I said what? And then we did what with it?
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm going to write it down like this.
Yeah. It's useful when we edit our Nice Games Jam episodes because we always edit like a week or two after we record. And that's useful for us because it's kind of fresh, so we don't like take any of our assumptions on the recording. And for Nice Games Jam, it's especially so when we're editing those because it's like we lose all the presumption. We look at our notes and it's like, okay, this doesn't explain the game we played.
Right, yeah.
And then you listen back and you're like, okay, now I sort of remember. And it's like a weird sort of forensic operation. Mm-hmm. Even when yourself are the one who came up with the rules and wrote them down.
Yep.
You've always like you're taking yourself out of yourself for that, just that 1 hour, and you come back and you're like, wait, why did I, what was I, what was the point? Oh, I see. Yeah. It's because I had it lying on my desk. Now I understand. That's why.
So you mentioned it right at the top. It hot.
Oh yeah.
It's hot here in Minneapolis, but like, I think we have no right to complain
No.
because it is
For once.
It is epically, you know, world's first heat wave in the UK. Mm-hmm. How are you holding up?
I am okay. I got a little bit away with it in that I was fortunate to the studio I run, Bay Jester, we were like, we need aircon, please. Oh God. So we managed to source that the other week. So I'm okay. But I have friends up and down the country, especially in London, where it's a 41, 42 degrees, 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah, and they're not having a great time. It's a lot of batten down the hatches, windows closed, don't even think about opening the door. It's not great. It's not great.
It's like Arizona temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't have the framework with which to deal with.
Exactly.
Right. Like there was extreme cold in Texas last year, and they couldn't handle it because they're not used to that. And they're having similar problems now in the summer, even though it's Texas. But one of the things we do have in the United States is we have air conditioning everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In homes and businesses. And I just read recently that's extremely rare in the UK. It's mostly businesses only will have them, and very rare to have them in homes. That is such an unusual, like, it feels so. Of all the things that feel foreign about foreign places to me, that one actually seems the most unusual to me, because you're just so used to that being a feature of the architecture you live in. It just never made sense to invest in all that until now and probably going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just not really been, I think, part of the architecture because, you know, our temperatures have never really got too high or too low to really require it. We've always been sort of middling. But it's in my head, it's one of the things when I've been out to America, it's exactly that, is that you go into every building and it's just a cool level every single time. It's like, oh, it's quite gentle and nice. Whereas here, you get on a train and you're being cooked alive. You get off the train and torrential rain happens. You just go, yeah, that's our weather. That seems about right. Okay.
So when, like, baking directions or something says room temperature, does that just fluctuate depending on
the room? Wildly depending where you are in the country. You know, if you make it in Scotland, it's going to just be flat. If you make it down sort of on the south, it's just going to rise to about three times the height. Like, that's just part of our cuisine. You know, that's just how we
Well, you sort of bring up, like, the phrase room temperature is part of our culture in a way. Do you even use that term in the UK?
That's a good question.
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's weirdly to think about that we use it, but I've never actually thought about, but what does it mean? What does it mean in this country? It doesn't actually mean anything. I think it's sort of that kind of, it's okay. You could step out. I think if you could walk around and it's just about room temperature. But yeah, we don't use, it's not often used. I think it's more, you know, we just say, like, the weather's, it's all right. That's about as detailed as we get.
Right, the carry-on, right? Yeah.
mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we've delayed long enough.
Yep.
Why don't you go ahead and present your concept for your nice thinking, and maybe tell us where you want to start the brainstorming.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start us back a little bit, going back about a year and a half, which is going back a little way, back in sort of 2020, mid-pandemic. I just was sort of struggling to remember things and not in a great place for time retaining information, but in a way that I'd never really recognized before in my life. And that was quite worrying, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to my, at the time, fiance about it, and I talked to my friends about it. And one of my friends said, oh, I am investigating and seeking a diagnosis for ADHD, and it sounds like something that could be relevant to you. And I was like, it could be, maybe. And then we shared a lot of memes with each other, of which my favorite one is one that says, either these memes need to stop being so relatable or I need to see a doctor, which kind of summed it up, really. And I was like, oh, hang on a minute. And so I ended up over here in the UK going and speaking to my local GP, as we call them. And they were like, just do this very simple test. It was sort of, it's a marker, which I did. And it was like, you kind of hit like 95% out of 100% for possible markers. So you probably want to go speak. We'll put you on to speak to someone, which I was like, okay. And through a whole kind of process, which I'll talk about later on, ended up with a diagnosis of ADHD, which for me was ADHD combined, which basically means I can be a bit hyperactive, can be a bit inattentive. It's a mix of the two. And when that happened, I was like, well, you know, it was wonderful to have it, to know what it was and to understand. And I was like, right, and now to return to the games industry and find all the support that's there. And there wasn't really a lot, which was a bit of a shock to me, mostly because a lot of my friends who had also got it also are from the games industry. And there's been a wave over here, certainly, of people being diagnosed in the games industry with ADHD. And recent, we have a census over here run by kind of the top level body for the UK games industry. And it turned back, and this is generally accepted as an underestimate. It was accepted that it's about 1 in 10, which for proportion is the same number of people who said they were an artist 2D or 3D, which is just a wild proportion.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so lacking that kind of resource or knowledge or anything like that, I kind of was like, well, then I'm going to do something about it. Like, it's time to bring it back. And where I wanted to start in particular was, and this is where I wanted to come into my thinking, is like, how do we, and this is not just for ADHD people, it's neurodiversity in general and people in general, how do we help kind of set up, whether it's our businesses, our spaces, our communities, etc., to be mindful of these people and support them kind of coming into the industry, being in the industry, and also, you know, games across the board. It's kind of, as a space, it has the capacity to really draw in people from a neurodiverse background. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that we're kind of keeping, you know, we are preparing for that. And that's kind of where I wanted to go. So it's quite a broad spectrum, pun intended, broad spectrum kind of topic on looking into ADHD and neurodiversity in the games industry and how we can kind of make sure, even at the base level, we're keeping it in mind and supporting people, essentially.
It's interesting because it's like, it feels, as you described it, it feels like, oh, okay, you kind of know where to go. You got like, you have a goal in mind.
Yeah.
But then there's the actual, like, what do you, like, logistically build to make that happen? I mean, that's your challenge, I think. So the first question is where are you now? What have you got so far? Because I know you've started a little bit getting this on its feet, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I started, I sort of went, the starting point for me is always is the point of reference. There's got to be somewhere that kind of signifies whether it's the information, whether it's a point of connecting with people or something. Mm-hmm. So I'd come up with a name and a very loose logo to sort of be this point of reference. But at the minute, exactly what defines that is very much kind of up in the air. You know, I've had a thought about, is it a resource bank, and is it just kind of just having the information available? And I've connected with two other people in the industry on this side about this, trying to figure this out. Is it a community space somewhere people can go? Is it just being at events? And more so than that is at what, you know, what point is enough or not enough? You know, do I need to be more proactive in kind of talking to businesses and event spaces? Do we need to have our own events? Is that more important? I managed to run. So we just had kind of the biggest conference in the UK for the games industry as from a trade perspective. So it's basically, it's just for people in the games industry called Develop.
Mm-hmm.
Which I ran a meetup for people with ADHD in the games industry just to see if people would turn up. And we had about 30 people turn up to just be, and this was kind of the first ever event of its kind. There really hadn't been an event for people with ADHD specifically. And yet we had people who had been diagnosed for 5 years, 10 years, people who were self-diagnosed, people who were, you know, seniors in big companies, people who were brand new, all of which were incredibly appreciative of there just being a space for them to be and to meet other people like that. And again, all that does is kind of reinvigorate, one, the fact that we need these kind of things, but also two, kind of, why hasn't it happened before? Like, why is this happening? It's taken someone to come along and kickstart it, but you're kind of like, this is a space that should have existed. But regardless of that, I want to figure out exactly how to help these people as best as possible across the board, because if we can create a better space, a more welcoming space, a more open space, and help the people, you know, people be themselves, then that can only lead to good things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing with respect to like meetups and such, I think that meetups can be powerful because you can see other people, you know, in locations that you are, who are dealing with the same things that you're dealing with. And I think that's very powerful. But I mean, even with virtual events, that's still kind of limiting because you have to find the event. And
yeah.
Sometimes, I don't know, everybody's schedules are different. And if you schedule an event at 8 o'clock Central Time, that might be 2 o'clock in the morning for someone else.
Very true.
So I think that events can be powerful, and I think that that is valuable to have. But my immediate thought is thinking about like a set of guidelines or something for studios to help support folks with neurodivergent folks or people with ADHD. That is my immediate thought, but I don't know how other people are feeling about that.
Yeah, I think that ties into what I think, like you're saying, like you don't know what it is will be enough to make it have an impact. And I think, Steven, you're getting into the advocacy part.
Yeah.
Is it's like, it's fine to organize and have events and support, but then you want to have influence outside of that space you've made for yourself.
Yes.
And that's where that comes in.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, yes, we want studios to take note of this, but what do we actually want them to do?
Right.
And so coming up with those sort of standards is pretty difficult. Like about like policies, but also like communication strategies.
That's true.
Yeah. There's a ton that needs to be done in what you've described, and you can't do it all at once, and you especially can't do it all right out the gate, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing I feel like, I think the place to start is, how are you going to narrow your vision to the thing that you're going to start with, right? So I guess the first thing that if I were trying to solve a really big problem or at least make a dent in it, is try to just listen to what the challenges are. Yeah. So my question for you, just to kind of start that in a little bitty way, is when you were starting to reach out for resources in the industry, what resources were you hoping to find? You know, like what questions were you asking that you then got nothing back?
That's a very good point. So when I started, I started by being very scattergun. I wonder why. And just sort of looking for anything that kind of linked up. And the thing that kind of, shocked is probably too strong a word, but surprised me certainly, was that most things in the UK games industry have either a charity dedicated to them specifically, or certainly have something that represents them across the board. And from the starting point, there was one charity that kind of mentioned it within their remit, but along with another sort of 30, 40 things, because they were trying to capture a lot of things around mental health and stuff, which is absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing dedicated to it. And I reached out to somebody who kind of represents, does a lot of work in kind of diversity and inclusion in the UK games industry. And they said, yeah, like they've been looking as well to try and figure out, and they're the one in charge, and they've been trying to figure out where are the resources. And it's kind of been that. It's kind of been the fact that there's been nothing has been a surprise. So a lot of my knowledge and information came from my own research, came from studying things. And to be honest, one of my major sources of it in the games industry, ironically, is another American podcast, which is a game development studio in St. Louis. And I'm going to forget the country. Country? What am I on about? State. There we go. country. Country's going back a little bit.
Missouri?
Missouri? There's a team called Butterscotch Shenanigans who made the games.
I've met them.
Who made the game. I've digitally met them, but I've not met them in person yet, but that's cool. But they did again, there's another one I went back to the beginning of the list all the way through. They go through a period where the three brothers, one after another, realize they have ADHD and get diagnosed and could talk about it. And it was fascinating to listen to that as I was kind of going through my own process and kind of go, oh, this is what this means. This is how it's affected them and how they changed their studio to manage and how their studio is set up to manage that. And that definitely was a good starting point. But certainly it's kind of the research information is sporadic at best. It's kind of, there's a little bit, there's an article here, a post over there, a podcast here, but not a huge amount in any kind of go-to place. There's nowhere that I could say, oh, if you're looking for information about ADHD in the games development and games development and games industry, go here. And I think that's probably where I'd wanted to start, but couldn't find.
Yeah, kind of like a locus of information that's a good place to start when it becomes relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
I think one of the interesting things for me as well, just on top of that, which is to your point on guidelines as well, Stephen, is that I it's definitely something that I want to do and kind of like be like, oh, this is how we work it. But one of the first things that I've found, especially with the games industry and people in general, but particularly the games industry as well, is that a lot of people have a very misconstrued image about what ADHD is. And a lot of people, you know, if you say, what is ADHD? Generally, their image is kind of a small boy who can't sit still. And that's kind of it, full stop. Mm. And it's just so, and that causes problems in so many ways. Because for example, when I was 13, we met a family, my sister's best friend at the time. We met her family and stuff. The son of that family, a guy called Isaac, who's fantastic, is ADHD, but very hyperactive. He's just pinging off the wall all the time, boundless energy. And my mom talked to his mom and was like, oh, how did you know that he had ADHD? And she said, oh, well, he did this and he did that. And, you know, I turned around and he was gone and he wouldn't come back. And my mom kind of recognized, was like, oh, but Adam does that as well. But at the time, it was just like, oh, he does that, but it doesn't seem to be affecting him, so we'll leave it, which is fine. But it's this idea that, and this comes up all over the place, unless it's disrupting your life actively at that moment, unless it's doing something that it's not worth pursuing, or that it's not, you know, it's just, unless it's a major catastrophe that's literally affecting you, like clearly affecting you, then it's not a problem. And that, not only is that bad for people in general, it's particularly bad for women being diagnosed. It is like the numbers are so poor on women being diagnosed, and that is a massive problem, because obviously, you know, it affects kind of how you perceive the world and how you interact with the world. And until somebody comes along and goes, oh, hey, this is what ADHD is, and it's correct, people could not know for 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you talk about like that. Discovering it is a process that takes a lot of things to line up, right? Yeah. Like we described, like how it's diagnosed in children. A lot of that it comes from the energy of you know, the guardian who can identify those signs and then recognize that there's something worth doing about it. And I think that because it is seen as something that kids have. And so when you're an adult, you don't look for it yourself. So I think a lot of those guidelines would have to be about like recognize just education about what it even is. But I think the tricky part is you also have to present that in a way that is digestible, right? Because it's not just a storehouse of information you're trying to create. You actually do want to have something that is, you know, the user experience of it all.
Yeah.
And some of that has to come from, I assume, medical experts. And so have you thought about having seeking out advisors to help craft these things? Because, you know, we aren't always the experts of our own experiences, right?
Yeah, I have. I'm fortunate that here in the UK, we have kind of, and I mentioned at the beginning, we have this kind of baseline test, which I think is called, off the top of my head, I think it's called DSM-5, which is a wonderfully developed name that, you know, clearly tells you what it is straight off the bat. It's basically kind of, I think off the top of my head, it's 5 initial questions and then 13 additional questions, which is meant to be a prediction of how likely it is you have ADHD. Mm-hmm. And it's something, it works something to the effect of, if you answer, 6 questions and 12 questions, I remember to do the others. Mm-hmm. If you answer 4 of the 6 initial questions in a certain way, it is like a 90% chance that you have ADHD, because it sets up kind of the core components, and the remaining questions are all additional markers to kind of like confirm and double down on that. So in the first place, that's a really, obviously that's relatively bite-sized in terms of a starting point, but, and this is the bigger problem, as is your point, is it's, you know, if you said, go to someone and say, oh, do you think you might have this? Quick, here, take this quick medical test and find out. That is not, nobody is going to answer positively to that. Yeah. And it's exactly that. It's whether it's reframing that, or whether it's coming back a step from that and being like, this is a thing, you know, have you ever felt, not to turn it into an advert, have you ever felt like a, have you ever felt like this? But certainly it's that kind of, you kind of need to get the, first you need to find the people and but also you need to kind of draw them into it. Because, and this is one of the big problems with it, is that everybody thinks how they think is how everybody else thinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you fundamentally have to accept that that might not be the case before you can even start this process.
Right.
And that's a difficult thing to break down depending on the different people. Certainly I spoke to somebody at Develop who's a bit older than me who said, oh, I think I might have a bunch of the symptoms and da-da-da-da-da. But, I don't know if it, you know, what would be the, you know, what would be the benefit of doing it? What would be kind of be the point at this stage? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, and even, so even when people who even think they might have ADHD, you're still fighting an uphill battle of kind of what's the point? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, for me, and I sort of talked to him about it, it's about understanding how you work in a way that means you can actually utilize that. And I won't go into the full details of that one. But certainly, one of the things that typifies it for me, and I don't know if this is true in kind of the US game industry, and also I end up, if no one stops me, I just end up talking forever, but that's just a separate issue.
Keep going.
When you're young in the UK kind of education system, you are taught about the three different types of learning. You know, you've got visual learners, you've got audio learners and kinesthetic learners. You know, you learn by seeing, learn by hearing, learn by doing. And here you kind of have like a lesson or two lessons on that. And, you know, wow, this, it fundamentally defines how you learn as a person. And then it's never mentioned again. And like, that doesn't, it's not like you've learned like, oh, you learn by listening. Let's change your educational program to make sure that you always have some kind of listening resource, because that's how you work best. They kind of tell you, and then they go, well, that's a good fact to know about yourself. Now back to writing in a textbook. And you kind of go, oh, what happened? And that's the thing with ADHD and autism and, you know, the whole kind of gambit, including of neurodiversity as well, that it fundamentally underpins how you perceive the world. But it, you don't even get as far as being told that it kind of exists. You just kind of learn about it by accident one day when it's like, oh, that guy's got ADHD, and that's it. That's all you know. So I have forgotten what the original question was, which is, it's standard. the user experience of it all. Absolutely. It's kind of, it's breaking down a long form barrier to kind of create this starting point. And I think maybe it's finding a way to resonate with people. I think that seems to work the best when somebody can see something in a story that connects with them in a way they didn't expect. Suddenly that opens people's minds.
Yeah.
So just to kind of summarize what we've heard so far, first of all, it doesn't surprise me. This is a complete tangent, but I think we can get back on track quickly. The learning styles thing is so interesting because it actually isn't very much of a thing. The learning styles isn't supported by evidence per se, mm-hmm. That like someone's completely auditory or completely visual, yeah, or completely kinesthetic. A lot of it depends on what you're trying to learn. But the spirit of what you were saying, in that they're like, okay, there are different ways to learn, and we're never going to talk about it again, and also we're going to continue to teach everybody in the same way, that's the core of the problem, right? Like, even if you learn a lot about yourself and how you best learn, and what you need to do to get your brain in the best learning condition, you're not able to practice that because the education system that you're engaged with is one size fits all.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a problem here in the United States too. But it's also a problem in the working world, right? So that, I think, brings us to the issues that you're seeing and what we're kind of circling around. So, you know, if you have ADHD, my husband has ADHD, so we talk about this quite a bit. And it's not the same for everybody, but like your brain will work differently than everyone else's brain. And that's true for every single individual. But like, there is a certain degree of, well, neurotypical like expectation. And so if I, as a neurotypical person, I'm going about my workday in a certain way, and generally it's successful for me, I'm going to just innately have the assumption that it's going to be the same for everyone else.
Right.
And so when I say, yeah, I think it'll take me like, I need a couple hours to just focus on this and then I'll come back to it. And what that means for everyone is, you might be able to interrupt me with some direct messages, but like, I'm not going to jump into a meeting. Mm-hmm. For someone else, it might mean I am not going to be available for these hours and you cannot talk to me because it will destroy my concentration.
Yeah.
Just random examples. So if you don't know that about yourself, then it's easy to just feel like you're bad and broken rather than just different. like wired in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard. I think it becomes harder for people to advocate for their own needs if those needs, if differences in needs aren't validated.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. it totally makes
right,
sense.
Right.
Just to add on to that point, and this is one. This is actually the thing I was saying to the guy down at Develop, which was exactly that. Which is one of the most fascinating ones I've been reading about these days is routines, mm-hmm. and that ADHD people do not have. You can't have routines. It doesn't work. But they think they do, especially when they haven't been diagnosed. They don't recognize it. And the way this comes up was, for example, the one that I read was when you go to brush your teeth. For me. And this is with a great deal of knowledge and learning about it. It is every single day. It is an active decision. I have to decide to brush my teeth that I normally hooking into like getting changed or something like that. But for example, the days when I've already gotten changed for whatever reason, the odds of me remembering to brush my teeth go out the window. Because I don't automatically remember. It doesn't build it. It is a decision made. Like I am now going to go and brush my teeth. And that for neurotypicals, that's not the case, or so I'm told, that they just kind of do it. They have already brushed their teeth. It just kind of rolled into it. And that goes up to every level. And the big one is like committing to a sports, an exercise regime. Mm-hmm. And that if you are, you know, the world is full of do it, commit harder, get motivated, get a planner, just write it down. You'll do it for 2 weeks and then you're done and you're solid. And it just doesn't, that's not how it works for ADHD people at all. Mm-hmm. I did a 10K run and 10 weeks beforehand, I was like, I can't run more than a kilometer. I'm going to look silly. And that was enough motivation for me to run like almost every other day for 10 weeks and get to the 10K and run it and do it in a perfectly reasonable time. And then it immediately dropped off. But like that should have been enough to set a routine in place right. because it's 10 weeks of consistent yeah. running on a consistent time and schedule and it all collapsed. And I said to the person I was talking to, if you didn't know that you had ADHD and you tried to commit to a work regime and you did 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then it all faded off, you could so easily blame yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're being told by people, oh, you're not working hard enough, just do it harder. You can do it. Like, mm-hmm. you just absolutely commit, you know. It's all on you, the determination. It's got to come from you. Mm-hmm. If you believe that and you believe that you should be able to do that, you could so easily fall into a spiral of blaming yourself, of self-doubt, of poor self-esteem. Because if you can't go, I have ADHD. This is not how I'm meant to work. I need to come up with a different way to do this that works for me. Then you can end up in a really sad place, essentially. And that's a big yeah. part of the danger for me.
That's so, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because something just clicked for me. I've had so many conversations with Eric over the years about like the difference between his brain and my brain. And something just clicked for me that we've talked about ad nauseum. And that's about workout routines. He's a very, like very dedicated athlete and he's doing triathlons this summer and he's like really working towards the thing. But his entire approach to fitness is goal oriented, right? So he like picks a race, he's going to do that race. And then he works towards that goal. And then when that race happens afterwards, it's like a whole disaster, right? He feels like he's actually got like post-race depression and he's working through how to handle that too, because it's like there was this huge high and all this dopamine associated with every time he made progress towards making that big goal. And then it's gone. The whole thing's gone. And for me, he always says like, well, you know, you should like pick a race and you should work towards that race. And I'm like, it's not, that doesn't work. I have to structure my day in a way that's consistently going to work from day to day. Like, mm-hmm. otherwise it doesn't, you know, it race or no race, it won't matter. Like it needs to be like a day to day thing. And that's, I wonder if that's really the core of that difference.
So we ask people to do various bits and bobs yes. in these middle sections of the show. And thank you, dear listener, if you're not skipping through this one.
Appreciate it.
But one thing we haven't asked recently is to load up Ye Olde Apple Podcasts and give us a review. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, kind of boring for us to ask for that.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like you've heard that on every podcast. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we're not that serious about it.
Yeah.
It's time to get serious.
Yes. Do it. Let's go.
Because it's useful for people to find the show, but also it's a great way to leave some public feedback on the show. Mm-hmm. So if you say something like, hey, more of this, less of this, like it's harder for us to ignore that.
Yes.
Because it's out there, you know, I'm just saying.
Other people are
speaking to, you know, to your personal motivation is why you might want to give us the 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the other reason is like it's a little weird like promoting Apple Podcasts, but like that's the place you leave reviews.
Yeah.
You can also leave reviews on a couple of other different services, and if that's the one you use, please do. But the place people go is Apple Podcasts, and I'm loath to admit it, but that's where you should go almost exclusively to leave your review of the show.
Yeah.
Please do.
Yeah.
Steven, you agree?
Yes, I do.
Ellen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have quorum here. All right, that's it. That's the end of the thing then.
Yes.
All right.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, it's interesting you talk about in those terms, because I think like that about routines and about the and actually, Adam, as you described, like the actual difference, like the brushing your teeth example, I think that's some like laying it out in those terms, I think will help people on board to the process of self-discovery. And so phrase, you know, having your resources framed in that way, mm-hmm. not less so much like a clinical diagnosis as more like a I mean, a little bit like a quiz, like, you know, how do you approach this topic? Because these are things that, mm-hmm. as you say, you don't think you're different. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, people don't compare notes on a lot of this stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think the other half of that, and I know this is something that I think I suffer from, is I assume that I'm different from everybody else. Like, I feel that, but I don't feel that that's different from other people. Like, I feel that they're also different from everybody else.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so it never mm-hmm. occurs mm-hmm. to me that what is different about me is worth exploring in any, you know,
yeah,
in any sense. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like a lot of people must feel that way. It's not always that, yes, my experience must be normal. It's that my experience must be as abnormal as everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like having it a way to actually just drill down and actually just get concrete examples. And that's difficult because not everyone's going to respond to each one of those concrete examples.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And it, as people have said, everybody experiences things differently. So, like, if you have ADHD, you'll still experience it differently from someone else. And so, like you were saying earlier in the show, you were sending memes back and forth with your friend. Not everybody is going to relate to those memes in the same
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
So, it might not feel like. And in fact, I think a lot of times people will see some of those memes and go, well, I don't really experience this, so I must not have ADHD, even though you experience like 50% of the other ones or something like that. So I think that I think that test thing seems really valuable to just be mm-hmm. able to like take this test and see maybe you have it, maybe you don't, and then this can right. help you do that. But mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess the framing of it would be important.
I mean, you also have to think about like the Scientology personality quiz, right?
Oh, mm-hmm.
which is like, you know, hokum, mm-hmm. And has a goal at the end to recruit you into this way of thinking.
Yeah.
And so you also mm-hmm. have to kind of avoid that, especially as an advocacy group.
Yeah.
You don't want to be caught in the trap of like, let's try to get more people to identify as this, which I imagine would never be your outward goal, but you could kind of work towards that because you know how many people are undercounted.
Yeah.
And so it could be very easy to start questioning your own motivations. And that's why I brought up like medical advisors.
Yeah.
Is like making sure that there's because I think that mental health in particular, I think is a difficult subject because a lot of people, they feel unheard.
Yes.
And so they christen themselves the new experts.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big danger.
Yeah.
Because everyone is trying to do the right thing.
Right.
And there's a lack, and then there's like building trust, you know, in expertise, but also the fact knowing that there's lots of holes in that expertise, that like, you know, the experts aren't always right about these things. It's a very complicated subject. And I think when you say like a simple quiz is useful, but it's also, that's also the starting point to a bad road.
Sure.
And I don't have a lot of advice on how to avoid the bad road because I also agree having a simple endpoint seems vital to me
right.
to have that. But it all, but just in my head, like, it's also kind of dangerous.
Well, okay, so like maybe in first steps could be just finding resources on medical advisors who can help you understand better how your brain works, and then they can help you determine whether or not you feel like it's worth it to go and take a test, like a detailed test, not a 12 quiz test or a 12 question test, to see if an ADHD diagnosis makes sense for you or not. I think that's a good way to start about it, because then you're following the science and you're asking experts to help you determine these things, mm-hmm. instead of you just making your decisions on your own. Like self-diagnoses can be scary.
Yeah,
it's like how if you feel sick, if you feel like your nose is runny, and then you go on Google and it tells you you're dying.
Yeah,
it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like a self-diagnosis,
yeah.
It can be motivated.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But also because neurodiversity is a spectrum, mm-hmm. It's also kind of okay a little bit. Like I guess I'm trying to say it both ways in a sense. Like if someone feels that they've self-diagnosed themselves, mm-hmm. and maybe a medical expert would disagree, mm-hmm. there's a problem with that. But also it's not exactly the problem you think it is. Yes. It's not the same as diagnosing yourself with a blood disorder because you read at WebMD.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad mm-hmm. you clarified.
If you don't reach sort of a clinical level,
yeah.
well then these resources can still be useful to you.
Yes.
I mean, there's a sense of like the self-discovery aspect is very important. I think it's important mm-hmm. we all are able to be honest with ourselves mm-hmm. and have information we have.
Right.
But I don't mean to overstate the danger of self-diagnosis.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. I want to jump off of that for a second, because I'm thinking of this in terms of like who are the people that we're trying to serve.
Yeah.
And we have a large group of potential users who are non-neurotypical mm-hmm. uh-huh. game devs.
Yeah.
And then within that, we're talking about ADHD, which I think is a great place to start, because it's nice, something we have experience with because of our guest. But then within that population, we have another subset, right? We have people who have an existing diagnosis and they know about it. And then we have the mm-hmm. second half, which is people who don't know that they have it, right? And I'm curious about what drives that second group, people who do not have a diagnosis. What conditions are driving them to ask the question, do I have ADHD?
So on that, I'm actually going to split that. One further, because and this may be a UK specific problem then, as opposed to an American problem, but when your local doctor says, oh, you took the shorter test, you might have it, da, 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 there is a process before you can then be formally diagnosed, because you need to be interviewed by a specialist. And where I live, and in most of the UK, that timeline can be 2 years. So you could be. And that's if they pass you on. And somebody that I met at the lunch, they had been told by separate university doctors that they almost certainly had ADHD. But when they went to their doctor, they were basically told, because it wasn't actively disrupting their life in a very demonstrable way, i.e. they weren't going to prison, it hadn't caused them, hadn't caused them to go to jail or anything, mm-hmm. and they completed their degree in 6 years instead of four, that they were not going to be considered for diagnosis, because they decided, because probably because they had to apply for funding to do so, and they were like, well, it's not actually disrupting your life that much. And for me, that's one of the big things, is that there are exactly that group. There are people out there who are self-diagnosed and want to be diagnosed, but can potentially suffer from imposter syndrome without that formal diagnosis
that prevents
them from accessing that information. And that's sort of like the good typifying in here in the UK of that second group. And that third group, which is the most interesting of all to kind of consider, are those who could be perceived as having ADHD, whether through their behavior, whether it's, because there's a huge genetic component if their family has it. Mm-hmm. There's a phenomenon of, I don't know if you know the expression, birds of a feather flock together. Mm-hmm. There's a phenomenon of neurodiverse people who don't even know they're neurodiverse end up in big groups of friends because they all think alike and are more comfortable in each other's presence.
Yeah.
Like I was saying, it was one of my friends who did it. And in that group of us at least 6, 7, 8 people now have either since been formally diagnosed or in the process of having ADHD, because we all get on and we all can, you know, we all click with each other. Mm-hmm. But there are people who, you know, could have ADHD and either don't know about it or actively like, oh, you know, it's not, that's not me. And that's also a really interesting group because it's such a difficult one because obviously there are a lot of benefits to knowing, but obviously you would have to break down kind of why do they want to not know almost. Because, and this then goes back to kind of like, you know, if you believe it is a disorder as opposed to being sort of a neurotype and just how some people are, then mm-hmm. that's a bigger problem. I also think, and this is based on what Steven said, I think the first page just needs to be memes, just straight up. If you connect with these memes, please read on. That has got to be that's
the X-ray informal
step
test.
One.
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of the points that you've stated and then we've stated are important, but I think that when people are thinking about how they've been handling things, especially older people, you learned kind of how your own brain works in a way where it feels like the diagnosis might not be useful. Like you've kind of just established, well, I have a hard time creating a morning routine, right? So I just won't establish a morning routine. I don't necessarily need an ADHD diagnosis to determine that I don't like morning routines. So it might be like that kind of thing. Like they've already kind of established or they've already understood how their brain works and they feel like a diagnosis won't really help them improve upon that aspect.
Well, they've built a whole universe of coping mechanisms.
Yes.
And whether it's as successful as it could be or not, but going down that path means abandoning all of the things that they've done so far.
Yeah.
Feel a little bit like, you know, that could be an identity crisis.
Well, yeah, even if those coping mechanisms stay in place, it feels like they could be, you know, it's unfamiliar territory.
Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. right. It's almost kind of admitting you're wrong a little bit.
Yeah.
In a way, which can be
massively
difficult to face. Yeah. Right.
It's true.
And there's a huge, you know, especially in across all kind of neurodiversity, I've spoken to people about this. I was fortunate that I kind of, it didn't play a huge factor into my kind of process, but a lot of people, when they go through the process, end up feeling grief for, you know, especially for those who have had difficult lives of who they could have been had they been told earlier. You know, the problems that they faced had they been aware of at an earlier stage, they would have been able to do something about it, or they would have had the accommodations necessary to support that. And my one, to exactly your point, up until pre-pandemic, I would never have considered going and getting a diagnosis. It was not even close to on my mind, even though I definitely had it, and it was definitely a huge part of and impacting my life in a way that I didn't understand. And only by having it sort of shoved in my face by all my coping mechanisms being basically trashed because pandemic.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a fun time? Isn't that a fun time?
Yeah, it continues? It's great.
Isn't it currently? But the, you know, not everyone's going to have that. Not everyone's going to have that kind of that moment of where they are confronted with it. And exactly that. It's hard. It's hard to accept that you're wrong or that what you believe may not be true. And that is a tough position for someone to take.
Yeah. What we're really circling around is how your initiative, like how it says hello to people, right? And what audience is it focused on? And I don't think we've answered the question, but that's okay. But I think it's important to have drilled it, like really gotten deep into these issues, because it really does matter when you present yourself as this organization that's committed to this topic, this issue, advocating for this audience. Identifying who that audience is, who it could be, who you focus on. And going back to, I think, what Ellen, you were saying earlier about like where you start, you do have to kind of focus, I think, about like, we're going to focus on this corner of the issue with the goal of focusing on the rest of it, because it can be really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I think we've laid it out pretty clearly, like how big a topic it is, just in terms of like, who walks through the door and what that, you know, how do you approach each individual person, which, you know, uniquely is a more challenging with this kind of initiative than other types. And so I think the thing that I've learned in when I was working in a nonprofit in college was this concept of strategic planning,
okay,
which is a sort of a formal process where you sort of decide this is what our organization's goal is. This is what our immediate long-term, what our attempts to reach that goal will be. Mm. These are our short-term and long-term goals. And it's very formalized in a way. And it lets you kind of decide what you're doing this moment rather than measuring every action you take against the biggest goal you've got. And I think that would be a good strategy for you, but it also depends, and this is the question I'm going to ask you, on the makeup of an organization. Are you, I don't know the legal status for nonprofits and charities in the UK. I assume there's some analog to how it works in the US, but do you intend to establish yourself as a formal nonprofit, as a charity? Do you want a board of directors? Do you want, what's the format for the initiative?
So certainly in the first stages and for a while, I would probably not formalize it, just because you don't have to formalize to exist, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And the moment that you do formalize, you become subject to certain restrictions. Right. There are certain time, you kick off certain timers that are like, oh, if you've been a registered organization for 2 years, you no longer get this funding, goodbye. Which if we're not prepared for, then we wouldn't want to miss out on opportunities and such.
Yeah.
So I think in the first case, it would be trying to establish that kind of space while existing. You know, what does the space look like? I think the key thing for me, certainly from an organizational perspective, would be having as much in terms of that representation of subgroups as possible, because as we sort of alluded to, ADHD is not just ADHD and you're done. You know, there's also ADHD and other things. There's also, you could be a man or a woman, or you could be non-binary, or you could be of different races, and all that plus ADHD has a dramatically different effect. And me just coming into it being like, this is what ADHD is for everyone, here you go, is not correct. Like, I will paint a picture, but it will be my picture, and it will resonate with some people, but it won't resonate with others. And it would be wrong of me to kind of go into it about that. So I definitely want some kind of board who can reflect as much of that kind of varied opinion as possible.
Right.
After that, it's a difficult one. It kind of structurally is not something I've kind of dived into in my own mind, because I just kind of attack things from the front and I wonder why I do that. But it's certainly, again, another kind of good point in kind of, you know, how you, especially with that kind of strategic planning, because again, ADHD people are known for not being particularly good at goal setting, despite the fact, like, just as your husband kind of pointed out, we kind of need goals to strive for to help us kind of be motivated to hit them in the first place. So in terms of that strategic plan, how does it suggest you define goals? Is it quantitative? Is it smart targets? Is it more kind of esoteric? How does it kind of suggest going for those goals?
You essentially have your mission statement, right? So this is what the organization is. So it's actually not that different from like a game design document, in the sense that you have this thing that like your actions are measured against, but you also have essentially like a 5-year plan. And so, and it is different for different organizations. Like, you know, for some that, you know, that are longstanding, it can be a fundraising goal, or it can be a, we want to have a presence in these media markets, or whatever it is. I mean, it really is very independent, but it is specific to those organizations. So I don't have a great answer for you. It's essentially something that you and the people you want to work with will have to kind of come up with. But then the key part of it is that you stick to that plan. Because, and like a game design document, facts on the ground can change, and then you need to revisit.
Yeah.
And so I believe there are mechanisms for that revisiting. But the idea is, the way nonprofits generally do this, or tend to do this, is they do like a kind of a retreat where everyone takes the day, you know, takes a couple of days, and they don't do any of the normal work, and everybody works on this. Mm. And then the work is done, and then that gets put on the shelf. And then as you do your regular work, you check back on that to make sure you're keeping in line with those plans, rather than sort of planning as you go, essentially. Right. And I think part of that is due to, this is a supposition on my part, but I believe part of that is due to this extreme resource constraints that nonprofits tend to have. This of kind of strategic planning process can be done by, you know, corporations as well. Sure. But I'm not super familiar exactly, but my understanding is it's much more common in the nonprofit world, because you don't have everybody's time or energy that you can focus the way you can a group of employees. And so it can be very helpful to, everyone gets together for the first time in a couple of weeks. Well, we all remember what page we're on, and it's the same page. Mm. And that's a mechanism by which you can do that. But it's essentially like you take a couple of days and you do a kind of a camp where everybody kind of hammers it all out together. There, and I'll, we'll put some resources in the show notes because I couldn't, off the top of my dome, I couldn't help you with the specifics on how to set that up or establish that as a plan. And you can adapt it to the size of your organization and how it works. But I think what I'm hearing, and I think what I want to get to next is what I'm hearing from you is in terms of like how you want to formally structure the organization, it's it seems like it's important for you to first establish a presence and do some good before you get into all of the minutiae and legalese and all of that. And I think that that's a pretty good way to start, because then when it's time to make those decisions about how many subcommittees do we have, you know, you'll have a sense at what your capabilities as an organization are. It'll be less aspirational. You'll have some things under your belt. And frustratingly so, it's kind of okay for it to be a little messy before then, because you sort of need to find yourself as an organization. So I wouldn't be scared of not having all those plans right away. But like a 5-year plan, it might be useful for you to have a timeline that you set up for yourself. That once we hit this threshold, we need to take stock, you know, and see if it's time to move to the next step. Did we meet the goal we wanted to meet? If not, should we start over? Should we change tack? Schedule out some decision points, within the next that could be months, that could be years. So that, again, when you're thinking about what I'm going to do for this next conference, for our presence there, what I'm going to do for this meetup we're going to plan this month, you're thinking about that and not thinking about the bigger goal that it's going to do, because you've already thought about that and you've put that on a piece of paper somewhere. That you can adapt that kind of thing to a more informal setting. But it seems like the first question then is, how do you recruit people to help you run the thing? How do you get that diverse board or diverse group of people who put it together, whether it's officially called a board or not?
So I, in the first instance, I reached out to a friend of mine that I've had for about 6 years, who's I've made through the games industry. She's at a relatively senior position, but has also been diagnosed for a long time. And somebody else who went through the process in a similar time frame to me, but then at Develop conference, gave the first, while I ran the first kind of event for people, she gave the first talk specifically about ADHD. So I was like, that you clearly care about, you know, advocacy. Again, somebody I knew for sure beforehand, but kind of going, you clearly care about advocacy, let's start this. And also because for me, I definitely wanted to, from the very beginning, just to highlight the kind of the female and kind of all perspectives on how it manifests, because the research, it's hard to say the research is wrong when there's a lot of smart people have done a lot of information, but they kind of say the generally accepted ratio is 3-1 on it turning up in men to women. And I'm not 100% sure that's actually correct, because the big thing they say is that it's a lot, is that, and this is true in all neurodiversity and autism and all these kind of things, is that women learn from a much younger age about the importance of like social norms, this kind of thing, and are much better at masking and pretending it's not real. And that hides it from a lot of doctors and stuff who don't know the absolute detail of what they're looking for and how, and what it looks like when people are masking as well. But so I found them because they're people that I knew. But after that, I haven't talked too much about how specifically to reach out, apart from when I was at this, the lunch that I ran, I had a plan beforehand that I would have already kind of announced that it existed and that kind of thing. And then it was the day before, and I was like, I wasn't meant to launch this. That was a mistake. I launched a lunch. I hadn't launched the organization. But when I was there, what I did was very hastily in the morning set up a sign-up page just so I could capture the information of the people who were there, and said, look, if you're interested in the people who turned up, because obviously these are people who are of the games industry because we're at Develop, they are people who care because they turned up, they are people who are organized enough to be present and want to connect with this group and all these kind of things, that I thought they would be a good starting point as a whether it would be end up being a test bed or people to speak to or people who would be interested in being active. I thought that'd be a good starting point, so I had a sign up form to do that. And certainly while I was there, a number of them came up to me and said, I really like the sound of what you're doing. If you need any help, if you need any assistance, you know, I can help you out with this, that, and the other, and da 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 da. So I think that's kicked off the process in a good way. But there's definitely a question on, because you don't want to be in a position where everyone who says, oh, I can help, you go, yes, great. And then you have 30 people and you're like, hang on a minute, we can't organize this now.
Yeah, right.
They're trying to figure out exactly who and where and why is probably a really important one to think about for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and a lot of the questions you'll need to answer may just come from the sort of early brainstorming of the people who show up, right?
Yes.
And for it's sure. sort of an organic way to get that process going. But you know, and this is not unique to neurodiverse folks, but making sure that there's an avenue for people to participate so that when they have the energy to give, there's somewhere to put it.
Yes.
So whether that's like a Discord server or whether that's monthly meetups, something that makes it less of a job to keep up with.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That first point of contact, I think, is definitely a key. And making it clear and obvious and like, look, if you... And this kind of goes back to that key again of that, you know, how do you say hello? Which I think is a good summary of it. It's like, you know, when people, you can't know how people are going to interact with your group in the first instance. You don't know where they're going to find you. You don't know, you know, you can hope that if you blast out enough spaces that they can, mm-hmm. but you don't know where it's going to be. So if you can create an easy way for people to connect with you in the absolute first instance, whether it's, you know, they go, oh, let me just go to the website or the Twitter handle or whatever, and it just says there, like, want to reach out, click here. You want to tell us something, click here. Like, here's the link. This mm-hmm. is the thing. Go here. And it has everything. I think that's really key. And I think that in particular is a thing that I hadn't really thought about to that extent, which again, like, you know, it goes back to video games. It's exactly that. It's, you know, especially if you go at the mobile market, the first 10 seconds will define if somebody plays your game or not. Like,
right.
they'll
right.
shut it down and walk away. So if the first interaction with this group is trying to remember a username and then going to Twitter and like, okay, this is them, but is there a link here? Do I have to go through a bunch of tweets? Especially with people who aren't famous for having the greatest attention span of all time, that probably quite a lot would bounce off. And that would obviously defeat the point. So I think, it's thinking about that dynamic, that process of catch people, not only when they're ready to give information, but also making it as easy and straightforward as possible for them to do so.
Yeah.
Vitally important.
Yeah. A very curated pathway to you have a need and here's information.
Yeah.
And even just streamlining that a bit will help a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I want to close the episode on the role of allies, because I think it's for lots of organizations that's representing diverse groups, that is extremely important. But
yeah,
I would love to hear your take on what do you expect from the neurotypical, if that makes sense. Like,
prototypical neurotypical.
Well, it can be very important to organizations to be run by the people affected by a particular issue or part of a particular demographic. But at the same time, do you demand that of the people who participate? This may be a future problem, but you may have lots of energy from people who want to contribute who are not necessarily affected by the issue. And how do you give those people the ability to help, but also not put them in a place where they are, you know, in charge when they can't understand? You know, it can be kind of tricky, right?
Yeah.
Because I think it's one thing I imagine is a problem. Is, you know, you don't feel that you're affected by this issue. You've never had that inkling, and you know, and so it doesn't matter to you. And I think that can be tricky because that leaves a lot of energy on the table. But at the same time, you don't want to waste your energy reaching out to those people if you can't also help them. I'm sort of babbling, but I'm kind of asking you to do the same babbling. Like, have you thought about that? And what do you expect the role of sort of the broader community of game developers to be?
You don't need to ask me to babble. Don't worry. I'll do that all on my own. I'm fine with that. That's what I'm built for. no, it's fine. I think it's a really interesting question because there's, again, in that group, it's super interesting because we'll have, because in that group of the neurotypical and stuff, we'll also be the neurodiverse who don't know it. The people who, you know, they until they recognize that actually it might be a thing, they will also be, they will put themselves outside of that circle. And so you have to, you know, and even if they go like, oh, you know, because you've had it before where people go like, oh, but everyone thinks like that. And you're like, yeah, but they don't. And that's an uphill struggle. I think it really is. And it goes back to the point right back at the beginning of, you have to be open to, first, you have to be open to the fact that people think differently. Mm-hmm. But not only be open to it, but fundamentally accept that and be appreciative of it. Because just thinking, yeah, you know, people think differently, fine. But then if you demand things of people without taking into account, well, how is that going to affect that person? It's similar to you were saying before about the phone call during the day. Because there was a great thread on it a little while ago where somebody was saying, if you ask me, if you message me for a meeting, like, you've already messed up my day. And someone was like, what, just by asking? And it was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. This gone, like, whatever attention I had to look at your message, and I've gone back and this is all squiggles now. The whole thing has just kind of left the building. And that's not on any thing, therefore never ask me ever for a meeting. It's that it's being mindful of the impact that you are having before you have it, and being appreciative of that moment, because it's still fine for someone to ask you for a meeting, but if they know that it's going to mess up your focus, then they take that into account when doing so. They go, actually, can I book a meeting, or can I email you about it, and you'll get to that email when you do? Can I send you a WhatsApp message that you'll read when you get to it? Can I message you? Can I delay a message on Slack or on Discord to be sent in 2 hours or tomorrow morning or whatever it might be? Is there a way that I could do this that is going to be more appreciative of the position that you're in? Mm-hmm. And obviously that takes a huge amount of education. It takes a huge amount of learning. And certainly when it comes to, you know, people trying to help, I think the absolute basis is just being appreciative and understanding. And especially at a stage where the education isn't great, the people who are going to know the best are people who have ADHD, self-diagnosed or formally diagnosed, and have learnt about it.
Yeah.
And those, when they come to you and say, I know that you've done it like this, but if you do it like this, it could cause this or have this effect, to be appreciative of that knowledge, and to not go like, oh, well, that's not how people work, or, oh, that's not, you know, well, I've done it like this my whole life and it's been fine. If they're coming to you and saying it, then that's because it's something that's impacting their lives, and it's about taking that on board and building it into you, as opposed to being defensive or being basically not being sure that that's actually correct, and just being like, is that actually what it is? And I think that's the absolute first step, is just kind of going, if this is what it is, I accept that I don't think like this, and that's okay. And to give an example of where this plays into it still, my wife is autistic, for example, and we sometimes we clash every now and then on things, you know, as everybody does, but sometimes it will drill down to just that I don't think the same way that she does. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the fundamental bottom line of it. And I have, you know, I can't figure my way into that. I can't, you know, change how I fundamentally think. I have to kind of be like, okay, that's how you think. I understand what you're telling me, and I can understand how that could play into things. It's not how I think, but I understand that. And that is a level of trust that you would have to have in the person opposite you. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when it gets down to a certain level, and this is true for all things, you know, lived experience, people who have experienced, been in certain situations, people react to things based on how they perceive the world. And if you can get to a point where you can go, I trust you are telling me the truth here, and that this is how you do it, and I will act accordingly, then that's kind of that's the most important fundamental thing that to kind of roll with, to be able to work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like you certainly want the assistance and support of the neurotypical, but also it seems like what you're hoping to do is provide that education, not just to people who you expect to join and participate, but also to the broader community. And that,
yeah,
it's a sort of a dual purpose, right? Because it's like, yeah, you can make lives better for some, but you can't do that yourself. You actually do need the support of everybody else. And so that's sort of another category on the resources page, really, is for the neurotypical. I guess it really illustrates how big the issue is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the most recent stats have said something like 5% of humanity might have ADHD. Like that is not a small number. And it's not, like you said, it's not a number that can exist by itself. You know, we want to work together. And so it's not about educating one half or the other. It's about everybody learning more about it and working together and having a better time because of it.
I hope we helped focus your thoughts a little bit on, because I think,
absolutely.
What I've learned is that this is a larger problem than I thought, or larger task rather ahead of you.
There's a lot to do.
But I think, you know, I hope we've drilled a couple of these issues, and I do hope that you find a way to grow the initiative, whether it becomes, you know, a nonprofit eventually, or whatever the scale it decides to be for itself. I love to see you get there step by step, and I hope you keep us updated on your progress.
Oh, I will, absolutely. And I think one of the key things here is that this is I very often just kind of run headfirst into things, and just kind of do them, and don't plan, and don't think, and don't set goals and targets, or have a vision. Not properly anyway, and then it'll get to somewhere down the line where I'm like, why was I doing this again? What was the point? And it's very easy to lose momentum at that point. So even in having this conversation where it's like, well, what are your goals going to be? What do you want to do? Can you define it down? You know, what is going down to those finer details, like, okay, yeah, this would all be great, but if you're not set up to greet those people when they come to the website, and so if you've not thought about that, then they could bounce off and you don't get the impact that you wanted. And those are the kind of things that I would have been running off, you know, setting up the TV advert long before I remembered to set up the front page of the website. And that's, you know, that kind of take a step back and think is vital. It's been super helpful and I appreciate it.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topic, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter @nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and two types of merchants. And what that's about.
It's cats.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry.
We like hearing from you, so tweet back or email us contact@nicegames.club. Nice Game Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, you can stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, it's a special episode or not. We'll see. We don't know if we've done the numbers right. But that's it for this week. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.